Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The No Child Left Behind Act was signed into law by President Bush on January 8, 2002. No longer, it said, would American schools just have the opportunity to educate America's children. Schools would be accountable for their students' tested performance. By 2014, every student in America is expected to be proficient in math and reading. If schools fail to achieve adequate yearly progress, consequences follow. Failing schools will be first worked with, then worked on, and finally subject to corrective action. In 2000, Candidate Bush addressed a crowd in Oregon.
Accountability is the standard for all true reform in education. Someone will be praised when schools succeed. Yet someone must be held responsible when schools fail. Because you see, in our vision, no child will be left behind.
As American children sharpen their pencils, hoist their backpacks, and step into a new school year, No Child Left Behind is shaking American education. But is it working? We'll hear this hour that it may be in serious trouble. Tonight on Point, the early grades on No Child Left Behind and its tough path ahead. Have you felt the tests, the pressure, the heat of No Child Left Behind? Is it working for your school, for the country? Will America stay the course? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Alexander Russo, a freelance education writer whose most recent article on No Child Left Behind appears online at slate.com. A terrific article. Thanks for joining us, Alexander Russo.
Glad to be here, Tom. Thanks.
Great to have you. So take us in here. It sounds absolutely inarguable that the country should want to have its children reading and doing math in a proficient manner right now, let alone in 2014. It seems like a reasonable goal. What's going on with this program?
It certainly seemed reasonable and was reasonable in 2002 when the bill was signed, but in the 18 or 19 months since then, things have, in some regards, really gone off path for the law.
Why? I mean, what country doesn't need school children proficient in reading and math? Why is it in trouble?
Well, it's not so much that anyone disagrees about the end goals, but many of the folks who stood with the president when he was putting together and signing this bill, including some of the most prominent Democrats in Washington, have now decided that they're opposed to the bill for various reasons. And many of the education groups, teachers, state, and local bureaucrats who are having to implement it are facing a challenge and have decided that they maybe would rather not participate.
And we've got a lot of years to go before the goal is met. Alexander Russo, you describe some of the reasons that this new kickback is emerging. But to understand that, maybe we have to understand the basics of what's required by the No Child Left Behind Act.
Well, in essence, No Child Left Behind says that schools should make progress towards the goal that every student be proficient by 2014, as you described. And in the meantime, the schools that aren't able to do that should give some extra options to parents, notably an option to transfer to a better performing school or an option to seek some outside tutoring assistance.
And is the yardstick already being held up to schools? Are they being measured every year already?
They are. Last year they used was sort of a grace year, and the states and the schools used an accountability ranking system that they'd had in place previously. This year, the new system has come online, and for some schools, it is a tough challenge. And as a result, the numbers of schools identified as failing around the country has been, in some cases, sort of shockingly high.
Well, how high? Give us some examples.
The highest that I've seen was 78% of the schools in Florida were identified as in need of improvement, which means that they did not make adequate progress according to the rating system that the state set up to comply with No Child Left Behind.
78% of Florida schools getting a failing grade in this program? Is that what you're saying?
Essentially. And that's a pretty hard number for people to swallow and a pretty hard number to get your hands around. The number was also, the preliminary number at least, was very high in California. And that's a lot of bad news for people to handle all at once. And I think that's part of the reason that people are scratching their heads, if not fighting against this thing outright.
So how did it come to this? What is it about the structure of the program, if that's what it is, that leaves so many schools failing? And does that mean that the schools just aren't stepping up to the challenge, or that there's something unmeetable in the goals set out here?
No, I don't think that there's anything unmeetable about the goals, either the goals this year or the ultimate goal that every child should meet state standard. But the law does close a lot of loopholes that had in the past allowed schools and school districts to look good on report card systems. For example, the most obvious one is that the law used to allow basically whatever students were in the school that day would be tested, and sometimes either by accident or intent, some of the lower performing students weren't in school that day.
Johnny doesn't need to come tomorrow.
Johnny doesn't need to come tomorrow, and we'll look better on our report card.
Mm-hmm.
This law, No Child Left Behind, closes that loophole by saying that 95% of the average attendance of the school have to participate. Their grades have to be reported. And as a result, a lot of schools aren't used to that, and maybe are having a little bit of sticker shock now.
So on the one hand, you're saying that when it comes to these standards and tests, this law doesn't fool around. It doesn't allow ways to kind of hide in the shadows. And the standards of proficiency that it ultimately expects American students to meet are high.
The standards themselves are determined by the states, and most of them were determined, you know, five or more years ago. That's left up to the states. The states have to say what proficient is. Some of them have set the bar higher than others.
There's a range there. Okay.
There is a range. And then the students are asked to meet it by the law. But the basic idea of what's proficient is actually left to the states. There's no national standard in No Child Left Behind. And while I'm pointing out what's not in the law, there are no exit exams or high-stakes tests. People often confuse these things. Those things, which are very controversial as well, aren't in No Child Left Behind.
Those go to particular students' fates. No Child Left Behind speaks to the school, and it's supposed to build a bonfire under schools, under states, under communities, and saying you will be shamed if your schools don't make progress toward the national goal.
Right. It's not just shame, though. If it was just shame, I think that people wouldn't be responding. There's issues of control and money here as well.
Well, let me ask you about one thing. If so many schools are failing to make the grade under this program, it does open the door for parents to move their children to other schools.
That's right.
That would suggest that might be happening in great volume. Is it?
It isn't. And there are a lot of people scratching their heads about that. I think that the reason behind that is that changing schools is a fairly drastic solution, and most parents are understandably reluctant to change to a unfamiliar school, even if they're dissatisfied with the current school. And also, districts have certainly not made it very easy or pleasant for parents to say, hi, I'd like to change from your school to another school.
In fact, you point out examples in Chicago and elsewhere where the school districts make it downright difficult to get your child into another school that you might want to send him or her to.
That's true.
Okay, so here we go. And with all of that, you say that before the country ever gets close to those national goals of proficiency, this act may be derailed. What are the forces that are coming together to push back, to push it off the rails?
The forces that are coming together are some of the education groups, most notably the largest teachers union in the country, the National Education Association, some of the parents and community members who feel that their schools are being misrated or treated unfairly by the law. And then the third biggest player is the Democrats in Congress, who, though they helped write the law, and most of them voted for it, have decided that the law has been inadequately funded. And so they are in a strange position now. They say they're for the law, No Child Left Behind, but they are opposed to it until it's funded better.
Alexander Russo, we won't hear much more from you tonight, but stand by. We've got a special guest joining us right now from Washington, D.C. Gene Hickok is acting Deputy Secretary of Education, former Secretary of Education for Pennsylvania under Governor Tom Ridge there, now wielding a lot of sway in the whole world of No Child Left Behind in American education. Gene Hickok, good evening, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. We're checking in on No Child Left Behind to see how it's doing, if there's progress being made toward the great big goal of all American children being proficient. We're reading in Alexander Russo's recent reporting that there is a lot of pushback out there and maybe some disillusionment at this point. How do you read that? Do you agree that this initiative may be in trouble? And if so, who's pushing back?
Well, a couple of things. I think the good news, and if you spend a lot of time scanning newspapers, the newspapers that cover the school board meeting, the back-to-school editions, mm-hmm. things like that, all across the country, it's a very different back to school this year. In the past, you know, the typical story was about bus routes and lunch menus. And now it's about schools and performance and choices or lack of choices and where's AYP and how does your school stack up to their school?
Who's up, who's down, whose annual yearly performance is looking good this year?
Yeah, and that to me represents kind of a culture shift in the conversation of American education. That's the good news. There is pushback. There's pushback, as human nature suggests, anytime you suggest fundamental change. Most of the pushback, however, is coming from the leadership of the education organizations, not teachers. Teachers aren't politicians. Teachers just want to get the job done. It's from the leadership of the unions. It's leadership of the superintendents' associations, the school boards' associations. Some of it is understandable because they've been doing certain things certain ways for a long time. They've all had their own agendas in place for a long time, and this certainly forces them to adjust that. So that's understandable. But some of it's a little bit more pernicious. Some of it is the desire to make sure that options and choices are limited so that they can hold on to money they think is theirs. Some of it is resentment because the law forces them to identify the challenges that they've in the past closed their eyes to. So there is some pushback.
Are you saying that union members, that school superintendents, that school boards are lazy? They're stuck in a rut? They don't really care about proficiency that American children might have in reading and math?
No, I'm not saying they're lazy. What I'm saying is that they are part of a system that's been in place for a long time, and they're being asked to rethink that system.
One criticism that's raised is that as admirable as these goals may be that Washington has raised here, that Washington's not coming through with the resources schools might need to actually succeed. And so they're kind of condemning schools, some number, and in some states, large percentages, to something like failure. Gene Hickok, how do you respond to that?
I think the argument that there's not enough money being spent on American public education is quite simply a silly argument. The American taxpayer at every level is very generous on public education to the tune of about $500 billion this year on K-12 education. The federal taxpayer amount has grown exponentially. Indeed, if you look at just Title I, which is the large federal education program, the biggest single title, in the 2 years of the Bush administration, that has been increased more than in the previous 7 years of the Clinton administration.
So there's plenty of resources out there, you're saying.
There's plenty of resources. The issue isn't how much money. The issue is how do you spend money. And that's why this law is so important, because it's all about accountability and making sure that you spend money wisely.
We hate to think this way, but is it possible that the American education system is just not up to the demands of reaching universal proficiency in a dozen years, even with all the motivation that this law, No Child Left Behind, is putting on it?
Well, I mean, if you don't make changes, you're exactly right. That's why this law is so important. Because if you look at the last 20 years of taxpayer spending for American public education, and then you look at test scores, while the amount of money skyrockets, the test scores are flat. So if we weren't about changing American public education, the argument that we'll never get there is accurate. The point is, this law is all about changing American public education. And it's all about starting with knowledge. The fact is, you can't improve without first knowing where to start. And this law creates those benchmarks.
Alexander Russo, Gene Hickok is way up in the Education Department, and he's putting kind of responsibility here way down at the grassroots of American education, saying that's where change has to happen. Is that how you see what's going on here?
I think that ultimately that's right, and I think that there is a big sort of cultural change that is required under No Child Left Behind, and it's a difficult thing. We are all used to, or many of us are used to, looking at education and things in a sort of a colorblind way. And one of the things that No Child Left Behind requires is that we look at how individual groups of students are doing. And
ethnic groups, racial groups.
That's right. And mm-hmm. that's something that's very uncomfortable. I compare it to changing to euros, changing currencies, that is. It's very, very hard to look at something in a different way when you've been looking at it one way, and if you asked Americans to change from dollars to euros, they'd have a predictable reaction. And one of the key elements there is the looking at how specific racial groups and economic groups are doing.
Yep.
We all don't like to do that very much.
Alexander Russo, Gene Hickok, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're looking at the fate of American children tonight, the No Child Left Behind initiative, and whether or not it's working. How do you grade the president's No Child Left Behind push? Is it working in your school? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the No Child Left Behind initiative and its impact on American education, whether or not it's making the grade. My guest tonight, Acting Deputy Secretary of Education Gene Hickok, joins us from Washington. From Chicago, education writer Alexander Russo. You can join this conversation as well. How do you grade the president's No Child Left Behind push? Is it working in your school, in your community, across the country? And is nationwide testing and the shaming of poor performing schools the way to go, the only way? Why are so many American schools still failing their students, failing to make progress? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. President Bush spoke to the No Child Left Behind Act and what's behind it just a few weeks ago, July 28th, at the Urban League in Pittsburgh.
I think too many of our schools are leaving too many of our children unprepared. And so we acted. I worked with Congress to pass what we call the No Child Left Behind Act. It says every child can learn. We must have high standards for every child, and we must hold people to account to make sure children do learn. We must challenge the soft bigotry of low expectations. And you know what I'm talking about.
President Bush in Pittsburgh on July 28th. Gene Hickok, Acting Deputy Secretary of Education. The soft bigotry of low expectations. It's a phrase that has resonated every time the president uses it. Is it still afoot in the United States today? What you say that there's a challenge to the way things have been done, implicit in No Child Left Behind. What's the fundamental challenge here?
Well, the fundamental challenge is something that was referred to a few moments ago, and that is this achievement gap. When the president talks about the soft bigotry of low expectations, he talks about the high school principal I met several years ago, for example, in Philadelphia, who loves her kids. And they're good kids. They're third or fourth graders in a crowded elementary school in Philadelphia, and they want to learn. And when you ask her how well they're doing, she'll say they're doing pretty well, especially when you consider where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't even realize what she's saying. She's saying because of the color of the skin or the household they live in or the neighborhood they live in or whatever, we shouldn't expect but so much from these kids. And that is a pernicious, pernicious thing that this law is aimed at stopping. It's not because that principal is a bad principal. It's because she's bought in, as many people have, into the notion that some kids we just shouldn't expect much of.
So if we've got the right goals, that is proficiency, in this legislation, and you say at $500 billion we've got plenty of resources, why are so many schools having trouble meeting their annual, yearly progress goals?
Well, because one thing that this law does is with a pretty high benchmark. When you go to a suburban district in one of our major cities, outside of one of our major cities, you'll see a district where lots of people spend lots of money in education and the average test score is pretty high. But all of a sudden with this law, they're being told, look behind the averages and look at different groups. Look at the different socioeconomic groups, and what you'll find in far more places than we thought are achievement gaps, even in good schools. And now the argument is, that school needs to be better because there's a group of students who are being left behind. That's why it's more difficult, and that's why it's so important. It's not saying the schools are failing or the schools aren't doing well, but in some places, they need to do better because kids, whole groups of students, are experiencing an achievement gap.
Jean Teacock, Alexander Russo, stand by. I want to welcome you to our conversation. Joining us tonight from Worcester, Massachusetts, Paul Revel. He's a lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, director of the Center for Education Research and Policy at the Massachusetts Institute for New Commonwealth. Good evening and welcome, Paul Revel.
Good evening. Pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Paul, you've spent a lot of time looking at the impetus behind No Child Left Behind and the details of what this legislation, this act, this great initiative of President Bush entails. And yet, so here it is. It's working. Everybody in education knows about it, but a lot of schools still aren't making the grade. What's wrong here? Are the goals wrong? Is the legislation wrong somehow? Is the effort just not there at the grassroots?
Well, I've spent a lot of time working on school reform here in Massachusetts that has a fairly advanced and fairly rigorous and demanding program of standards-based school reform. It's been in place for about 10 years, and so the biggest thing that we're looking at here in Massachusetts is how does this new act and this unprecedented role for the federal government and what becomes a kind of an awkward marriage here work with respect to schools in our state that are already well downstream in a very aggressive reform program. I think the principles that are embodied in No Child Left Behind are virtually identical to what most states in the country had adopted as their principles of reform, that is, high standards, a commitment to equity, a commitment to regularly assessing progress, to insisting on progress through a system of accountability that has rewards and sanctions, so that in principle, the No Child Left Behind Act is perfectly aligned with the kinds of reform programs that you see all across the country.
But you've written that implementing this act may be so difficult as to undermine all of its good intentions. Why so difficult?
Well, I think it's very tricky to put in place federal legislation and regulations that govern the activities that occur in 50 different states and some additional jurisdictions all across the country. I mean, you have historically, public education has been the province of state and local governments. Federal government has had a very limited role, and that only for the past 40 or 50 years. Suddenly, the federal government is moving in a big way here for important and good reasons. And I believe the things that Secretary Hickok was talking about in terms of equity and the demand for improvement and so forth. But it's a brand new role, and they're demanding, for example, 100% accountability while paying only 8% of the bill. And I also agree that it isn't just about money. It's about how money has been spent. But I think this is an act that's been put together very quickly in a short period of time. It was a top priority, to their credit, for this administration and for the Congress. They put it into place, and they wrote a bunch of regulations and put them in place in fairly quick order. And all of those don't necessarily work as well as the ideals behind them had specified. So I think when it comes to the actual implementation regulations, we're running into a number of quandaries in terms of the kinds of demands that are being made on schools and the kind of expectations about things like teacher quality, for instance.
Jean Hickok, how about it? Is this just a great big area that the federal government should just keep its nose out of?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, someone said a long time ago, it's one thing to write a law, it's another thing to make that law work, and we're in the process now trying to make that law work.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in a nation where, as the professor points out, and he's exactly right, it's primarily a state and local responsibility, and this law is really, in many ways, turning more authority over to states and locals with regard to defining teacher quality and how they're going to deal with those issues and how they're going to define adequate early progress and how they're going to define proficiency. But it does have the federal government saying, you need to do that. We're going to watch how you do that. We're going to help underwrite how you do that. This is going to be a bumpy road. Secretary Page says all the time, this is a complex law. This is a tough law. It's way too soon to revisit it. It seems to me that you need to give everyone a couple of years to move forward. But in the end, what matters most, money matters, the policies matter, the regulations matter, what matters most is attitude. We need in this nation to adopt the principle that it is just unacceptable in this country, this the richest nation on earth, to have an education system that is not delivering what it needs to deliver for every child. That will require additional changes. This is not the answer to everything, but that's the first step. And this law helps to open up more possibilities and to expose the problem and some of the solutions.
Paul Revel, how about that? I've read recently, and we all kind of know this intuitively, that traditionally there was a kind of triage in American education where some kids were educated to very high levels, a bunch of others kind of taught this and that, some stuff not in a systematic or rigorous way, and then another large group sort of completely abandoned, kind of warehoused and not really taught. You're saying the federal government may be out of its depth here or in the wrong place, but states and localities have had decades to get this right. And here I'm reading only a third of American children proficient by some measures in reading and math. Doesn't that indicate that somebody needed to come here and shake things up?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Tom, that we need to have a high standard for all our children, and all means all. And we need to give them the skills and knowledge that they need to be successful when they leave school to enter employment or to enter higher education and be successful at those levels. So there's no disagreement on that. The question really becomes, what kind of a partnership do federal, state, and local governments strike to do this work? And how do we see that it's accomplished? If we recognize it hasn't happened up until now, does mandating it, for example, make it happen, or do we need a concerted effort to build the capacity of districts, schools, and individual teachers to educate people to levels that they previously haven't been able to educate them to? It isn't as though teachers are withholding their best effort, or school districts are not hiring highly qualified teachers that are available for them to hire. It isn't as though we can simply make it so by mandating it. We've got to, for example, in the teacher case, we've got to do something to improve the market, the pool of people who are interested in coming into this profession. And that doesn't just mean compensation. It means all kinds of attributes of a profession have to be added to the world of teaching in order to attract good people and lots of people to want to do this kind of work.
I'm hearing a lot of mixed messages through this conversation. On the one hand, Gene Hitchcock says it's fundamentally about attitude. And then on the other hand, well, if it's attitude, that can be changed with existing resources, presumably. Alexander Russo, you write that it may ultimately be that there's a serious chance that it will be No Child Left Behind itself that will be left behind, that will be thrown off the rails,
right,
abandoned.
Right, and this has happened several times in the past, most notably in 1994 when the framework for this federal law was established and never fully implemented. But the real issue here isn't so much the federal role. The federal role has been growing steadily and is up to 20% of some big city school systems funding.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't necessarily that the local school districts can't do what's being asked of them. I think there's a real sort of over-eagerness to the law in some regards. Some of the timelines set in No Child Left Behind are very, very tight. And I think that there's some things that the Department of Education itself has done or not done that have sort of created this sort of perfect storm situation in which I think that there's at least a chance that this law doesn't get fully implemented.
Are you saying that a dozen years is not enough for the richest country on earth to figure out how to educate all of its children?
No, it's not the dozen years that's not enough. The early stages, the early requirements within the first year and within the first 6 months, within the first 18 months, some of those required states and districts to catch up on school reform elements that they had lagged behind on. It presumed that everyone was at the same starting point, and I think in some regards there was a too fast out of the gate quality, which has created some of the confusion. I think there are other things, though, that simply have been strategic issues. Letting No Child Left Behind become a partisan issue is an obvious one. This started out as a bipartisan bill and could still be, but unfortunately isn't. And
well, campaign seasons come and things get partisan, and as you say, in local schools, a lot of necks have been snapped back by the weight and the speed of these requirements. I want to turn to our callers. Marcus is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Marcus. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that I truly believe, having looked very closely at this legislation, it's fundamentally flawed, and there's an incredible gap between the rhetoric and the reality. And I think that was intentional, even down to branding this reauthorization of ESEA, No Child Left Behind. Very difficult to disagree with publicly.
So what do you think the consequences of this law will be, Marcus?
I think it basically it's engineered to practically destroy public education. And the principle that it's all based on, that so much of it hinges on, is scores on a single standardized test. So in reality, you see districts and schools that eliminate arts programs, eliminate gym classes, eliminate phys ed, like all these things in order to teach how to perform well on a standardized test, while at the same time, so many of our higher education institutions, so many of Ivy League schools, no longer require the SAT, which is arguably the most renowned standardized test in the country.
So it's pushing for scores while schools want to move away from that. Marcus, your line is a little rough, but we've got it. And thank you for calling. Gene Hickok, there's a call from your home state saying this is going to destroy schools, not reform them, that it's stripping the everything out of schools except the test taking. What do you say to that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'm very familiar with Marcus's hometown of Erie, Pennsylvania.
Mm.
And it's interesting because that is one of the school districts in Pennsylvania that I was familiar with because of their progress under standards and assessments and their great embrace of No Child Left Behind. The concern he expresses is not a new concern, and that is when you have testing and assessment, do you run the danger of teaching to the test, and do you run the danger of eliminating other kinds of disciplines that aren't being tested? Our response to that is that's not a problem with the law. That would be a problem with the way people would choose to implement the law. Good teachers have always tested. We've been testing kids in classrooms since the first classroom was built. Good teachers also recognize that you teach disciplines, you teach academic standards, not just what's being tested. And No Child Left Behind is the federal component of an accountability system. But almost every state, as has already been mentioned, has ongoing state accountability programs. They have standards in history. They have standards in science. They have standards in the arts. So if it's going to happen the way he suggests, that's not necessarily a flaw in the law. It's more in a flaw in the way some people would choose to implement it. And in most places, I think that's not going to be the case.
But there's Marcus working in education. And, wow, you've got a PR problem here, Gene Hickok. He's saying this is going to destroy schools
One of the PR problems we have, and it's not really a PR problem for us. It's a PR problem for those who have maintained the monopoly on education wisdom until we came along, is that in the past, the argument has been, if you want to know how well your child is doing, ask your child's teacher, which means whoever the teacher is the one who defines the success or the lack of the success for the student. There's been no relatively independent, relatively unbiased way to assess student achievement. It shouldn't be the only way you do it, but that's what standards and assessments are all about. It's saying, how do we know how well a child is doing, how well a school is doing, and then how do we take that information and inform our teaching and inform our curriculum so that we use the data to improve learning?
Well, there it is, and every parent knows how hard it is to assess that. Let's get a call before the break. Karen's calling from West Boylston, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a teacher who I've taught in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
Okay.
Before I came back where I grew up, and I taught there for about 7 years, mm-hmm. and now I'm teaching in a suburb, in a fairly affluent suburb mm-hmm. in Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
and I taught in a school where children really didn't do very well on the tests, and I...
In the inner-city school you taught at?
Yes, it was an inner-city school. Most of the kids were from the surrounding projects that were around them. And
our time is short, but with the new pressure brought on those schools by this law, do you think they'll do better?
I don't, because, I mean, I've listened to President Bush, and sometimes I feel like it's a personal attack on teachers, because if I were to be judged by the way my kids performed in New York City, I'd probably be a failing teacher. And there are other issues that are involved. And it's not blaming the parents, it's not blaming the home life, and it's not just writing them off. It's in no way doing that. And I feel like I'm the last person to ever say they can't learn, but there are other issues, and it's hard. It is learning takes the administration, it takes the parents, and it takes everyone involved. And when they have so many other pressures, they struggle. And here in the suburbs, I'm doing a great job. All my kids pass the test. Am I a great teacher now,
or is it just a different school? Karen, that's a great insight, and thank you for sharing it with us. Gene Hickok, will let you respond to that after the break. Paul Revel, Alexander Russo, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the No Child Left Behind initiative and whether or not it's working. Is Washington asking too much and giving too little? Or finally insisting that schools just pull up their socks and do their job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for
this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the No Child Left Behind initiative, the law, the legislation, and its impact on American education, whether or not it is making the grade, whether or not it might itself be left behind by an American education system that just doesn't want, in parts, to go that way. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight by Gene Hickok, Acting Deputy Secretary of Education, joining us from Washington, D.C. From Worcester, Mass., by Paul Revel, lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and from Chicago by Alexander Russo, whose article appears in last week's Slate.com, The Best Policy Flunking Out, Bush's Pet Education Bill is in Serious Trouble. Gene Hickok, just before the break, we heard from a teacher who said, look, I've taught in affluent suburbs and I've taught in tough inner city, and it's not the same thing, and I can do it in the suburb. I don't know if I could do it in the inner city, and don't blame me if I don't. This is a complicated chain of being that comes to roost in a test score. Okay. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, she's right. It is a complicated chain of being. There are lots of things that explain how well students do in every aspect of their lives, let alone test scores. But, you know, one of the goals of this law is to create the context in which it becomes impossible for this nation to continue to not try to deal with that problem. It's not purely an instructional problem. It's not purely an accountability problem. There are lots of things that go into the creation of a third grader or a fourth grader who becomes an eighth grader who can't read and drops out of school. But up until now, the preferred route has been there are a lot of things that go into it. We can't deal with it all. We'll just do the best we can.
Is it fair for the federal government to push from the top down? I mean, you're then talking about families and housing and nutrition.
And those are all conversations that this nation needs to have. One community at a time, perhaps. And this law will help force that conversation. It doesn't have all the answers. But I keep thinking that a couple of years from now, we'll be asking questions about American education that we're just beginning to think about because this law will force those conversations.
Paul Revel, is this the way to light a fire under all those conversations?
I think the federal government has an important role in providing focus to our national conversation on education, but it's also important that Washington recognize that they didn't invent standards and accountability. Many of us, as Secretary Hickok knows from his own experience in Pennsylvania, have been working on standards for a decade or more in our own states, and we've learned a lot as we've gone along.
Then why isn't performance better? Why are people uncomfortable with federal standards if people are already so accustomed to them and at ease with them? What's the big deal?
People are just getting used to the idea of improving performance and being held accountable. It's a massive cultural change in education where it used to be that trying hard was good enough. Now trying hard is no longer enough. Performance really matters. It really counts if kids learn things or not, and we're starting to hold adults accountable for their role in that.
But how long do we have if we're losing jobs to India and China now? If 12 years is too short a time, how many decades can the country afford to take on this project?
I think it's a matter of great urgency, but I think also any kind of massive change effort is a matter of timing and stress on the system. And we have to be very careful, for example, that we don't create a conflicting set of signals coming from the federal government about what constitutes effective reform that runs into different messages that state governments are putting out about what's effective education.
If I could just piggyback real quickly.
Gene Hickok.
It's really important to recognize that this law is all about state standards and state accountability and state assessments and state definitions. So it's not a national test. It's not a national standard. That's very important to recognize exactly what was just said. The states have been doing this. It does require each state to make some adjustments as it reflects what the state's doing. So I do think one of the big mythologies out there is that somehow this is Washington controlling curriculum or getting engaged in assessments and getting engaged in setting standards. It's really building on what states have been doing.
Paul Revel, let's hear directly from someone who's at the rock face on this. We're joined right now from Spokane, Washington, by Lorna Speer. She's principal of the Bemis Elementary School in Spokane. Good evening and welcome, Lorna Speer.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Ms. Speer, I understand that a decade ago, your school was one of the poorest performing school in Spokane, and now it's doing a lot better. You are staring right at the No Child Left Behind requirements. Are they working for you?
Well, actually, our reform started with those tests that were so low. So No Child Left Behind just kind of fits into where we're at. We're a high-poverty, large urban school in Spokane. 85% of our kids live in poverty, as measured by free and reduced lunches. But what we're seeing is across all ethnicities, children can learn. And it is about that attitude piece. It is about believing that all kids can learn and then looking deeply into data about your school through those assessments that help us do that.
You know, I'm impressed, Principal Spear. I'm looking at the flyer that your school gives out. And here it is. The bar graphs are right here for any parent to look at to show your performance stacked up against Spokane and the state. It's right there. And in some of them, you're doing very well. In others, not so well. But it's all right there for any parent to read. But does the hammer of federal legislation help you or hinder you? Does it make a difference? Is it useful for you?
Our state has really high standards. Washington State's Assessment of Student Learning, the WASL, is one of the most rigorous criterion reference tests that are being used by states now to measure student achievement. I think that's one of the issues around the state's control, and we want to have state's control, but there's a great range, as you spoke to earlier, between the assessments and the standards that kids are being held to. I think one of the things we haven't talked about when we talk about adequate yearly progress and each group of kids making it to that uniform bar.
Mm-hmm.
If we haven't talked about two groups of kids, and that's our English language learners and our special ed children, they're also one of those cells. And I fully believe that every child who lives in poverty, whether you're male or female, if you're black, whatever your ethnicity is, you can meet those high state standards, and our school's proving that. But if you don't speak English, you're not going to be able to be successful on any of the state's assessments because they're all written in English.
And are you saying No Child Left Behind doesn't account for those groups of students?
That's right. It's one of the cells that you have to meet that same adequate yearly progress. Your English language learners have to as well. And some schools are not meeting their adequate yearly progress goals because of their English language learner students.
Jean Hickok, can you speak to that from the Washington perspective there? Do you need some tweaking to this legislation to make it realistic for principals like Lauren Spear?
Well, on the special education aspect, you don't need tweaking the legislation. We do have regulations that are being pulled together because we do feel that, at least with their most cognitively challenged kids in special education, most states need to find ways, and most states are engaged in this, on alternative ways to measure student achievement. On English language learners, the law is pretty specific in that it says, frankly, it agrees with the caller from Washington, that it is imperative for these kids to learn English as soon as possible. There are alternative assessments that can be delivered in non-English until they learn English, and most states are trying to work in those areas. But that is an issue that needs to be addressed. I don't think it needs a legal address as much as it does policy at the state, local, and maybe some regulations at the federal level.
Jean Hickok, I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Listen, thank you, and thanks to everyone for the contribution. It's been a good night.
Jean Hickok is Acting Deputy Secretary of Education in Washington, and Lorna Spear in Spokane, congratulations on the progress you've made there, and we wish you well going forward.
Thank you.
Alexander Russo, as you listen to all this, with all the reporting that you've done, does it make you any more confident that this thing is going to stay in place, that the United States will stay the course and meet these standards by 2014?
I think that the overall success of No Child Left Behind is going to require a little bit more flexibility from the department in some areas than Deputy Secretary Hickok seemed to indicate. There's been a lot of time and still is a lot of time to make some regulatory fixes, and I think they're going to have to do that just to make the law more comprehensible and more reasonable seeming to people out there. Otherwise, they'll start to lose public confidence and public opinion will start to sway in the other direction. On the other hand, when it comes to the public school choice provision, I think they're going to have to be a little bit tougher and find ways to free up transfer opportunities for parents, because otherwise the law will be discredited and people will see it as an empty document.
Kids will be stuck in bad schools. And Paul Revel, we just got half a minute left, but what's your bottom line assessment? Can the United States step up to this challenge of complete proficiency 10 years from now?
I think it's a laudable goal. I think we can get close to that goal, but I think it's going to take an awful lot of work in terms of refining this law, as Alexander has spoken. I think it's, for example, we're going to over-identify too many schools as failing to meet progress, and we're going to create a kind of chaos in this choice mechanism of musical chairs here. I think we need to concentrate on building capacity, that is, building the skill and knowledge of people in schools to meet this ambitious new goal that we have. And if we fail to do that and concentrate only on mandates and a sort of gotcha attitude of accountability, we're not going to get there.
Well, watch out for a potential backlash here to No Child Left Behind. And you've heard the reasons that may mount up tonight. Also, the goals and laudable goals. Paul Revel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Paul Revel is a lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And Alexander Russo, terrific to have you.
Thanks, a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For weeks now, American children have been heading back to school. For Brookline, Massachusetts, fourth grade teacher Paul Tamborello, the first day of school is tomorrow, and it will be bittersweet. It will mark the beginning of the final year of a long teaching career. In this radio diary, Paul Tamborello reflects on preparing to say goodbye after 34 years in the classroom.
This is my last go-round. On opening day this September, I'll be poised on the dugout steps to start my final season, my 34th in the major leagues of education. The sound of the school bell at 8 o'clock will be my national anthem, the potent ritual moment of tradition and expectation, announcing the beginning of the action. And my last innings as an elementary school teacher. How did the years go by so swiftly? How much have I accomplished? What's my place in the pantheon of my school's history? More importantly, what's my place in the personal pantheons of the hundreds of fourth graders whom I've taught, advised, disciplined, and eaten lunch with for the past 33 years? During the next 10 months, I anticipate the bittersweet experience of watching the doors of a lifetime's career at the same school slowly swing closed. I can see myself grinning with a mysterious Buddha grin at the preposterousness that I'm old enough to retire. Every school day, a little voice in my head is going to be whispering, "Hey, Paul, this is the last time in your career that you'll be doing this routine." I wonder how many times I'll have to stop myself from writing suggestions in the margins of my teaching materials for how I can improve my delivery next year. As in years past, I'll revel in the miracle of, "Oh, I get it now." Reap the reward of watching kids plug away tenaciously at something they cannot yet do, and trust I'll have the experience as a teacher to know when to intervene and when to just get out of the way. I know that what I do in the classroom makes a difference in kids' lives. And by now, I'm comfortable with the fact that I don't always know precisely what that difference is. I'm ending my career with what most eluded me in the beginning: wisdom and perspective. In my rookie years, I envied the grasp my older colleagues seemed to have on their game. They knew how to play the questions off the wall as well as any left fielder in Fenway Park, and they never seemed to be in a day-to-day survival mode. I've taught in the shadows of giants and been astonished to learn that even the best of them battled spells of self-doubt. I've gone from promising rookie to dependable veteran. I survived, then thrived, but I also aged. It's time to go. I know that I'm one of hundreds of graying teachers across the nation who are fading into the field of dreams. When I pack up my bag at the end of this year, I won't look back. I don't have any illusions about how much I'll be missed. After 34 years, I know the game is more important than the players. I know I made a contribution to the people and to the culture of the school when I was there, and that I will not be in the lineup next year. It's time to go. There's still time to swing open another door, be a rookie again, and learn from veterans. It's time to begin again.
Paul Tamborello teaches fourth grade in Brookline, Massachusetts. Tomorrow, he begins his 34th and last year of teaching. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program.